that's what we were focusing on in Iraq.
Let me ask you on Condoleezza Rice. You're a former national security advisor yourself, but as Secretary of State, you testified in public under oath before this commission. She's refused to do so. Do you think she's right?
There is a difference between being a Senate-confirmed official in the government. We are supposed to be answerable to the Congress as well as working for the President, advice and consent of the Congress, and we all understand that. But the President's personal staff has a unique role. They are his intimate personal advisors, and the tradition and the precedent has been, even when I was National Security Advisor, that people in that position do not testify before the Congress. They talk to the Congress. They have meetings with the Congress. Dr. Rice has spent hours with the commission. They know what she knows. She has been forthcoming. She's indicated a willingness to spend more time with the commission. But in terms of going up in a public hearing, that is not the precedent.
The precedence aside, do you think she should do it?
I think that she would like to do it. I know she would like to do it. She wants to tell a story, but she has to consider the precedent that would be created by this, and that is where we are.
One more question on accountability and responsibility post 9/11, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The President, you, and many other people said there were weapons of mass destruction. None have been found. And yet, none of you seem to be terribly upset about that. Nobody's been fired. There haven't been any, you know, outrage from you or anybody else. Why not? Why has that been that? Why is that?
We believe, from everything we have been told by the intelligence community, by 12 years of history with Iraq, by the experience of the UN inspectors, and by other intelligence agencies in other countries, that Saddam Hussein had the intention to develop weapons of mass destruction and to have such weapons. And that was a sound judgment, which I still believe to this day, because he had had them in the past, he'd used them in the past. Second, he had the capability to have such weapons. He had the intellectual infrastructure, he had the dual-use facilities that could be used to develop these kinds of weapons. We also believed, because the intelligence communities thought it was a sound belief, that he had...
Shut the hell up, colon cancer pile. This nonsense about Saddam had the capabilities to make weapons of mass destruction, and he had the intellectual capabilities also in dual-use facilities. Look, Sambo, he didn't have the hardware, he didn't have the products, because you stopped selling them to him, and he didn't even have the commitment anymore. Then you babble on that I think Condoleezza Rice would like to go in front of the public, in front of the committee, in front of the public. Shut up, Jig. Look, even they can expose how jigaboo she is and how she's hiding behind a sideshow of lies and contempt for the truth. Then you babble out Condoleezza Rice, as the security advisor to Boy George, has a unique role. Yeah, instead of being a forced mammy slave to master on the plantation, Rice plays the willing mammy with a PhD in the New World Coon Order for her master. Just like you, colon cancer, you know what time it is, slave time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1, 96.3, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to start off right with an interview with some sisters and brothers who are dealing with a strike back against Safeway and other corporate conglomerates in the industry that are trying to break workers down into virtual slaves. And then we're going to go into the issue of resistance and strategies, armed and otherwise, for Palestinian people. Then Joe's going to wrap it up with a making it plain news update. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
By this golden rule, whatever happens, don't blow your cool. You gotta have nerves of steel and never show folks how you honestly feel. I've lived my whole life this way. For example, take yesterday. I breezed home happy, bringing her my pay. Her note read, so long, sappy, I have run away. I threw myself down across our empty bed, and this is what I said. But I was cool. So I went for the road, it at an all-night bar. Wound up so loaded I tore up my car. The judge threw the book at me, and when I read his sentence, there I said, I use it. That was cool. So I said, she's the only one I have to thank. And I found her and pulled my gun and fired point blank. The shot whistled right straight past that woman's head and killed my hound dog dead. As they carried me away, I was overheard to say, be cool, be cool, stay cool, keep cool, cool.
Okay, brothers and sisters, right now we're going to have an interview with some people that are doing, that have done some strike solidarity work and are trying to build solidarity among the working people for the upcoming strike. That is, on September 11th, the contracts are up for Safeway and Albertson workers in the Bay Area, and I think people know about the strike that took place down south. We covered it fairly consistently. First of all, I want to know, did either one of you guys see any parts of the contract that was settled down south? Do you have any idea of what they actually got? Annie, please.
One of the things is that they are cutting pensions, further pension benefits, 35% for all people who are employed. And anybody who comes in as a new hire gets 65% cut on the current pension benefits. They're really cutting back on health care. I think new hires are pretty much virtually out of health care.
One has to wonder why people voted for the contract at all, I guess. Just war weary, you know, the class war can make you weary. You can't pay your rent, you know, no money. I mean, a society based on money, to have no money coming in or to have $100 you know, a week coming in, that'll wear you down after 4 months. Joe?
Yeah, well, as I understand it, the workers didn't have much time to decide on this contract. It was proposed to them at the last minute. I know that there was a memorandum sent around stating that the UFCW recommended a unanimous yes vote, although none of the locals in Southern California at the time they sent out that memorandum had time to have a meeting about the contract. So, you know, that was just speaking for the officials themselves. Do you have anything else to say about that?
What I was going to say is that up here in Northern California, we really haven't had much information from our union. The pickets from Southern California were up here in front of our stores in probably November in front of some of the stores, and we didn't have an informational meeting about this until, what, about a month before the strike was over. So nobody knew what was going on.
Well, look, here's one of the, my understanding, I'm looking at the leaflet right now, and a very clear argument is made. That is, one, I think this is interesting, and people should heed this point. 48 million Americans don't have health care, and there were, or on average every year there is, 100,000 deaths that are the results of preventable diseases by Americans annually due to the fact that people simply don't have health care. So they don't go in, it doesn't get detected. A lot of times if you know you have a specific disease, there are cures for them. You get a shot, a little treatment, you're all right. This is something to think about. This is actually a very important moment here in American history. Now, what's going to happen? Well, I think the working class will decide, but let's take a look. Let's go back to something that happened recently. Both of you guys went to the meeting that the UFCW held at the Longshore Hall. Is that right? Okay, so now let's, first of all, my understanding, I was invited to the meeting, but I couldn't be there. I was at a board meeting that day. But my understanding, when I met the officials at Local 250 of SEIU, when they called for the meeting, was that they saw that one, they probably made many errors, but one of the errors they made was that the rank and file was not prepared for the conflict that started last October in Southern California. So they said, we're going to get the jump on it this time. We're going to get out there. We're going to make sure that people understand what's, you know, in front of them. We're going to make sure that people are prepared. Well, personally, I always think it's a good idea to be prepared. But I would like to know what you guys thought, just having gone to that meeting. What did you see? Did the meeting prepare people or what?
Okay, the meeting last weekend I went to, there was probably about 350 UFCW grocery workers there that I could tell, and they were mainly the hardcore militants in the union that had previously gone to union meetings. They weren't like the typical grocery workers that we meet many times and don't even know sometimes that they're in a union. At this meeting, there was not supposed to be mention of the contract that was recently settled in Southern California. Although several of the speakers that got up did in fact say that the contract wasn't very good, and a lot of people seemed to be very responsive to that. Having the meeting, just the general idea of, I think, was a good idea, and it was something I think that we should have encouraged. Unfortunately, they weren't able to get that many people out to it, the percentage of their membership. And one of the things they were saying also was that they don't want to see a large strike of 70,000 like in Southern California. They'd rather see it 100 here, 100 there, which I think is going to preclude the possibility of there being a more effective strike strategy. Like you saw somebody in the Longshoremen's Union, which I belong to, made a statement that they would stop cargo on the docks if the UFCW held a picket at the port. The UFCW leadership never took this up. So by them saying that they're going to limit it to store by store, they're just completely cutting out of the possibility of any kind of support like that, which would be very valuable, of the Teamsters stopping work at the distribution centers, the longshoremen, etc. So that's all I have to say about the conference last weekend right now.
Just a factual matter. Trent, who you know, Mr. Trent Willis, told me that over a thousand workers had signed in, that he actually saw the sheet. Now, I don't understand this, because you're saying 350. We're going to find out what Annie thinks is in a minute. Maybe people came and left. I don't know. But he says for sure 1,000 people signed the sign-in sheet. Annie, let me hear what you got to say.
Is that the one that was at the longshoremen's? It was more than 350, I'm sure, because I was there, but I couldn't tell you. Someone said it was about 2% of the union membership.
This is not a numbers game. We're just trying to report accurately as to what actually went on. Because at the end of the day, it's not about how many. It's program. Program first. What are you going to do? What are you advocating to the people that potentially will go on strike? And Annie, I'm also interested to hear from you whether you think that the people present were ready to strike, or were they demoralized by the outcome of the strike in Southern California? It's on you.
We broke down into small groups, and basically people were there just to listen. When the facilitator asked us for, you know, to participate in various things like checking on vendors that weren't supposed to be working in the stores, two or three people raised their hands, but it was really tentative. And what I'm remembering now is that I don't even have a contact number. I didn't get one when I was there for the coalition. So I don't know who to contact now. I'm waiting for them to contact me.
Well, they did actually send you a card, did they not? Okay. So they probably will. No. We're trying to get a handle. We're trying to get a handle on what happened. So obviously they're trying to rally the troops. They're trying to do something positive. What was the outcome? Do you feel that people were inspired by this meeting and were in a fighting mood when they left?
Okay, I have to tell the truth. I didn't stay for the whole thing, but I know there were a lot of people there from other unions. But I can say there has been this organization formed, the Bay Area Coalition, which the UFCW has hired organizers specifically for this Northern California contract that's coming up. And nationwide, actually, it's going to be almost twice the number that was in Southern California, contracts that are coming up this year. But they're making an effort here in Northern California. Their coalition is mainly made up of staffers, and they just meet with those organizers. We, the Bay Area Strike Solidarity Organization, is trying to get together and have more ongoing meetings that are open to anybody who wants to come. That's basically why we have our group and why we're promoting this forum. We'll tell you about in a moment. So I don't know if I have that much more to say about what came out of this positively. Maybe Annie can say something.
Well, you know, I asked the person that went, and they said that they got the feeling that people wanted to strike, that people were horrified by what the workers in Southern California had wound up with their contract, and they did not want to see a repeat of that. Well, okay, if that's true, Annie, tell me what you saw.
Well, I agree. people there were militant. Now, speaking from the store where I work, I don't think that's the case, and it's too bad there weren't more people from my store. I was the only one out of 50, 65 people. What we really need to do is get those people mobilized. Yeah.
Well, look, it's always going to be an uneven situation in the working class. Not everyone, the consciousness is not level and even for everyone. People have different levels of consciousness. Now, that's where leadership comes in. See, that's the job of the leadership, is to bring people up to snuff and prepare them to take an active role in the strike. But let's talk about this event you got coming up. I'm looking at this. So we don't want to get caught by surprise. That's good. Together and properly prepared, we are a powerful force. The Southern California grocery strike affects us all. Private employers will be trying to follow in the grocery chain's footsteps. Public workers at BART, city, and state workers, Muni and AC Transit, are already under attack. Organizing and fighting is how we can defend the gains of the past, not by relying on the boss's politicians. That seems to make sense. So, you're going to have a public forum Friday, April the 2nd at 7:30 at the Humanist Hall, 390 27th Street in Oakland, right off of Broadway. And BASO meetings, organizing meetings, are every Thursday at 5 o'clock at 2022 Blake Street. That's called the Grassroots House. Well, I got to ask you the basic question. Why? Why are you going to have this forum? Could you please explain to our listeners?
Okay. One of the reasons, like I was saying, why we formed the Bay Area Strike Solidarity Organization was at the time of the Southern California strike, there wasn't a lot of other groups up here in the Bay Area that were doing much to support this important struggle of the working class. It's one of the biggest strikes in decades. And we put out a call on some of the radio stations, KPFA. We had a couple hundred people come and raised a couple thousand dollars for them, for the strike fund at the time.
When was that?
I'm not sure of the date. It was February the 20th at the Humanist Hall. And we'd like to keep this as an ongoing kind of campaign that would continue into when the contracts come up here, and other contracts as well for city workers and other workers that are facing cutbacks. So that's why we're going to have a couple rank and file grocery workers from up here, from Southern California. There'll be a couple strikers talking about the lessons of the strike. Some of the organizers up here, and it should be a good event. Everybody should come.
Annie, why do you think the event is useful?
Well, if we can get enough grocery workers there, I think it's really important for them to hear from people, especially people that were involved in the Southern California strike. We need to know what's going on.
And I tell you what I think, folks. An injury to one is an injury to all. That's real. That's not just talk. It's not an empty slogan. It means that if they're able to abuse 70,000 grocery workers with a substandard contract, it's almost inevitable they're going to try to repeat that. Because that's money they take directly out of our flesh and blood. That's sick children. That's what it translates to. It translates to people not taking themselves seriously on the job because there's no real hope of retirement. So instead of being the best worker they can be, I can see a lot of people just job hop. You know, I wouldn't take it very seriously if they had cut my pension 65%. Oh, man. And now with Social Security, who knows? I mean, you know, with what the game they're playing on Americans with the Social Security, it is hard to predict what life would be like in 30 years from now. So I think we have to pay attention. We're not just out here supporting workers because we're trying to do nice things. We're supporting struggling workers. Is that right?
Right. Unions may be suffering from this at some point.
There's no doubt that people that are not in unions will suffer because the unions set the trend on wages and benefits in this country. So if they can beat us down, trade union people, then heaven help the non-union sector. That's right. They'll do anything. Who's gonna protect you? Now the problem is we have allowed our unions to degenerate, and we have allowed the officials to not be accountable to our needs. And that's why, Annie, I believe a lot of people weren't putting their hands up in that workshop when they were urging people to jack up the vendors, you know, who were doing union work. It's because people think, it's got right away, if I go raising hell like that at work, who's going to back me up? That's what people have to think right away. And if you don't, if it doesn't immediately occur to you, well, I know my shop steward is right there when I need him, and I know my other brothers and sisters are ready, and ain't no way they fire me, then that's a person, a strong union person, that's going to take care of business, like I try to do. But you know what? If you don't have that backup, oh, man, they run you off the job. Troublemaker. See? That's why how we relate to each other at work is very important. So would you please just give us, once again, I just want to make sure people know that Joel and Annie are advocating for a public forum that will be held Friday, April the 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Humanist Hall, 390 27th Street, right off of Broadway. This is being sponsored by the organization BASO, Bay Area Strike Solidarity Organization, and we certainly hope that our listening audience will urge their friends and family and co-workers to attend. Now, is there anything? We're going to close this out. You get the last word. Here you go.
Okay, this is an important struggle for the working class, for everybody, especially if you're in a trade union, but it's important if you're not. And 30,000 grocery workers here in the Bay Area, people, so that'll be one of the biggest strikes in the Bay Area as well in a while. And this is a union town, San Francisco, Oakland, so you know we got to do better than L.A. We got to at least try.
Just hope to see y'all there. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for coming this evening.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see where they've gone? They're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system.
You know what time it is now, Beyond the Shadow segment. And what we're going to deal with tonight is some of the issues that are going on currently in Palestine. The issues of how Hamas is organized, some of the real factors behind its organization, and is it really set as a revolutionary organization? So first we're going to deal with recently on KQED's NPR, you know, Talk of the Nation show. They had a host by the name of Neil Cohen. And he had on David McCorsey. He's from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And he's asked to comment on Arafat and the two-state solution issue. So we're going to deal with some of that, and then we're going to take it a little bit beyond the shadow. So first off, check this out.
Is Israel, do you believe, still committed to a two-state solution? Look, I think if you look at the polling data, a majority of Israelis want a two-state solution. I think at the core, though, they believe Yasser Arafat is not committed to a two-state solution. And so long as he's in charge on the Palestinian side, they associate, I think, a two-state solution with greater vulnerability and greater peril. And therefore, the focus has been more on Gaza. I think in terms of people, once you get beyond Arafat and around him, a lot of other Palestinians, you know, want that two-state solution, and that's the sort of two-state solution the Israelis want, too. But I think they feel, so long as Arafat's around, it's just not going to happen. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to deal with security cooperation. He's been, he didn't agree to Camp David or Taba or any of these approaches. There's been all these plans out there. If you think of the last 3 years, there was the Mitchell plan, the Tenet plan, the Zinni plan, the Roadmap plan. All four of these plans were all based on this idea of reciprocity. And then they all got mired in recriminations on who didn't keep the plan. So I think in a certain way, what Israel is trying to do, what Sharon is trying to do, is to say, forget all this reciprocity stuff. Let's just get going. Let's just start taking down settlements and let's just start pulling out. And I think most of the world will applaud it. I think Sharon, whatever you may think of him, is the only one right now in Israel who has the stature as the historic architect of the settlement movement to begin this gut-wrenching process. And by shattering the taboo and creating a precedent, there are clearly going to be more withdrawals from the West Bank, but it could be it'll happen in the post-Arafat era. Right now, they feel they have no partner.
This is almost comical that they could talk about, or this clown could talk about, the Israelis feel that they have no partner, when it's been clear from day one that the whole creation of the Zionist state in Israel was not designed to have any kind of solution other than the liquidation out of Palestine, Israel, of the Arabs. So to hear this clown go on and on as if, the Israelis have tried and tried again and have just come up empty with people like Arafat and others is really kind of a farce. What's also comical is that, Theodore Herzl, who is the architect, one of the leading architects of the Zionist movement, has long had a commitment of being obstinate towards anyone other than Hebrew lineage being in place. This is what I mean.
At the beginning of the 20th century, the rising consciousness of Arab nationalism comes into conflict with another ideology of equal passion, Zionism. Zionism is born out of the European Jewish experience, including the violent pogroms and virulent anti-Semitism that permeated 19th century Europe. By the late 1800s, Zionism's early theoreticians and leading advocates, including Theodor Herzl, widely regarded as the founder of National Zionism, increasingly characterized Jewish persecution as a condition of their people's statelessness in the age of nation-building and empire. Zionism's ultimate answer? The establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, the geographical nexus of the Jewish faith.
Well, the origin of the World Zionist Movement started in 1897 when there was a conference in Basel, Switzerland. Theodor Herzl, a Viennese, very much assimilated Jewish journalist, was the head of the World Zionist Movement. And in his diaries, he said that once we create a Jewish state, we will have the native indigenous population clean out the swamps. I guess he assumed there were swamps with snakes wherever this would be. He didn't necessarily focus on Palestine. At one point, he focused on East Africa for a Jewish homeland. And then we will spirit the indigenous population out of the country and deny them work in the country and force them out. In other words, exiling them, expelling them.
Now that gets to the heart of a lot of this aspect right here. Palestine wasn't even the original, quote-unquote, homeland to be for the Jews. It was going to be, they had their eyes on East Africa. Now, there's no way that they could fake it that this was some kind of manifest destiny in East Africa, that that they had coming to them, that they are some, you know, chosen people, and that they were supposed to be going back to the land of their people and all of that type of stuff. I mean, unless you were talking about some Ethiopian Jews or something, and they were already there in, you know, in Ethiopia. So this gets to how the whole construct right from the beginning was based off of basically what was going on in Europe at the time, as the European powers, France, Britain, etc., were the colonialists, the powerful colonialists of the day, and they were just vying for power. And then what ended up happening to European Jewry in that region ended up help play a part in what is now currently happening in Palestine, Israel. But it's, it has a core part of it based in imperialism and imperialist wars. But next, let's see how a caller named Gene, he asks the host and Mech Kosky about the other terrorists, not the ones on the Palestinian side, but the ones on the Israeli side. And what does that mean to this so-called roadmap to peace? So let's see how this is dealt with, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Well, let's get a call in from Gene, who's with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm glad to go just after the guest that you have interviewed, because he was saying things that that are a little bit problematic. First of all, I want to say that obviously the roadmap couldn't go anywhere and was doomed to begin with. The roadmap was calling for the disarmament of what's called the terrorist groups in Palestine. The problem is that those terrorist groups are just the army of Palestine to fight against the terrorist army of Israel, terrorist army which is supplied by the United States on the top of it. So, if you remember well, when Hamid Korea was prime minister of Palestine, there was some, he was faulted for not succeeding in disarming those groups, and that was one of the start of the dooms of a roadmap, and because this is a wrong basis for negotiations. Obviously, the Palestinians need to protect themselves against the abuse of Israel. They have been abused for 50 years now by Israel, so that couldn't work. Secondly, I don't believe that the Bush administration has any real interest in bringing peace in the Middle East. They are interested in catering to the Zionists, notably in Florida, because it's a key state to win the election.
Okay, Gene, we just wanted to give time for David Mikofsky to reply to some of the things you had to say.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't see how, what army goes and, you know, blows up people's and, you know, discotheques and pizza shops. I mean, Sheikh Yassin of Hamas and the whole Hamas movement, they are not using violence for a political objective unless you define political objective as the destruction of Israel, which Sheikh Yassin, to his credit, did say. He said, look, I want the destruction of Israel. I believe violence is the means to achieve this struggle. And he did not believe in a two-state solution at all. And frankly, his consistency was such that the net effect was that, it was terror for terror's sake. And therefore, for me, I think many analysts who look at this, they see someone like, the Hamas movement is no different than the Bin Laden movement. It's about pure destruction. It's not even about using violence to achieve a political objective of a two-state solution, which you can argue about in and of itself, whether how moral that is. But certainly in the case of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, who have conducted many of these attacks, they're very open about how they see it. They don't want the border on any line. They don't want a border, even if Israel was the size of Tel Aviv.
Yet,
and they're intellectually honest about that.
Some would say, though, that the assassination of Sheikh Yassin has only strengthened Hamas, which is clearly...
No, I think, look, I'm not here to support the political utility of such a move or the wisdom of such a move. But, I think the Israelis would argue that if the United States is justified in going after bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri, for them,
you know, they see Sheikh Yassin, who wants not two-state solution, has never advocated coexistence one day of his life, they see that no different than the hunt for bin Laden. Now, whether it is, you know, the political utility of this and the wisdom of this, whether it weakens Hamas in the long run, I think is subject to a very, you know, fair question, and it's unclear. The one thing I would just give, try to give a little psychological insight to listeners around the country, is that when the Israelis pulled out unilaterally out of Lebanon in the year 2000, they thought their move would be greeted as a move towards peace. And instead, when Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah of this area in Lebanon, said, look, it was our bombs, we blew them up, they ran away, and we think this will inspire the Palestinian uprising, which emerged 4 months later. In the Israeli mind, there was a link between the, you know, the pulling away out of Lebanon unilaterally and what happened in the West Bank 4 months later. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But all I can say is it's that mindset, it's that psyche that, in my mind, is what is leading the Israelis to do what they did with Sheikh Yassin. Oh, they will see Israel pulling out unilaterally as weakness, that Israel's giving in to terrorism, the terrorism pays. Well, this is a way to weaken Hamas over time. Now, whether they're right or whether it'll prove to be counterproductive, I think only time will tell.
David McCoskey, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Neil.
Okay, appreciate it.
Now, once again, this McCoskey guy, is this going into a bit of a rewriting of history and mysticism? There's an element of truth, like when he says that... you know, if the Israelis look at if Sam has the right to go after and justify bin Laden, then they have a right to go after this, you know, Sheikh Hassim. Well, it's kind of, there's an element of truth there because, you know, the Israeli government helped create Hamas as a counterpoint to Palestine, I mean, to the PLO, and Sam helped create bin Laden as a counterpoint to what was going on in Afghanistan and the Soviets' involvement in Afghanistan. Now that they feel that they don't need their Frankenstein monster to the same degree that they once did, they feel that they can more or less go after them, or at least propagandize like they're seriously going after them. So there is an element of truth, but this whole nonsense about you know, the Israeli mindset, you know, they may be thinking that, you know, if they pull out of these settlements and stuff, that may show in the minds of the Palestinians a weakness and all of that. I mean, the Zionists have laid out their program so many times, and their actions and counter-reactions have laid out what their real goals are. So, when he talks and says, you know, he doesn't see what kind of army goes after people and blows them up in discotheques, when he's talking about Hamas and groups like that, when you had a record of the Israeli government being involved in soft target killings, blowing up homes, running over people with their little you know, instruments of death that they've gotten from America. When they killed Hassim, they killed like 7 or 8 other people at the same time firing missiles at them. Now, their only target was Hassim, but the fact that there was some other collateral damage was insignificant to them. And this history of contradictions and how this plays in to the imperialist programs of that day and today deals with a lot of things that have gone on, including the Balfour Declarations. And here's what I mean by that. Check this out.
But Lord Balfour's promise of independence for the Arabs starkly contradicted two other key British pledges. The Balfour's Declaration avowed support for a homeland for the Jews and an agreement with France to carve up authority and power in the Middle East between two imperial players, France and Britain. Ramsay MacDonald, future head of the first Labour government in Britain, saw this quite clearly and, after a visit to Palestine, commented. In Palestine, I learned that during the war, our government authorized the previous High Commissioner to advise the Arabs that we would establish an Arab state on the condition that they would support us in the war. At the same time, we promise to give Palestine to the Jews as their national homeland and to facilitate Jewish immigration in every possible way until the Jews are a majority in Palestine. And at the same time, we made an agreement with a third party, namely France, according to which England and France were to have divided Syria, Palestine, and Iraq between them. Thus, we have assumed three obligations, each of which contradicts the other.
The reason was that Britain had already decided in 1917 that it was going to support Jewish nationalism, Zionism. So it issued the Balfour Declaration, and it made sure that the terms of the mandate for Palestine were written so as to give the Balfour Declaration pride of place. In other words, it was featured. In fact, the terms of the Balfour Declaration are repeated in the mandate for Palestine. So there's the idea of a Jewish national home, the idea of the Jews having national rights, the idea that the British are supposed to set up a Jewish agency, which is supposed to be an international body that would represent this population. All these things are set out in the terms of the mandate. The Arabs and the Palestinians, the word Palestinian is never mentioned in the mandate. So they don't exist. They're there. But they have they're not entitled to anything. Their civil and religious rights are supposed to be protected. That's the only mention. And they're only mentioned as the non-Jewish population. So basically, the Arabs were, as it were, eliminated from the very terms of reference for the mandate at the very beginning of Britain's rule over Palestine.
So once again, you see how imperialism and the imperialist wars and jibing for position, colonial positions and otherwise, played a part in creating this tragedy that you see taking place. This is why, in the end, it's a revolutionary type of position that has to take place to solve this. All of this, you know, getting caught up in this ancient disputes and, you know, and Allah versus, what's the other stuff? What are these guys called? The Hebrews, you know, Jews and all that. I mean, see, this is this. Look, there have been Jews in that region for years, you know. So the conflict is when you have, or the major next stage of the conflict is when you have Britain basically giving out three decks of cards to different people. One was to the Arabs, saying they were going to support them if the Arabs supported them during the war. Then they said they were going to support the Jews. Then they're telling France, you know, you can have Syria, Palestine, and Iraq. Yeah. So here they are giving the okay for a whole nother imperialist nation that you're going to have the right to carve up how you see fit. See, these are how the real nexus of the thing. So when you see these guys on KQED going into all of this other jib-jab talk, they're not dealing with the core aspect of how capital market systems breeds antagonism, hatred. And if you have leaderships that are based in, you know, these ideological religious based types of movements towards quote unquote salvation and freedom, you'll always be trapped and mired in this rhetoric. Now, next, let's hear on KQED Rashmi Kadami. He's an Edward Said spokesman like guy from Columbia University. And he's asked by Neil Cohen about, do the majority of Palestinian people want a two-state solution? So let's see how Kadami deals with it, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Where they see the process going, as we've heard opinion polls suggest, most Palestinians would still offer a two-state solution.
Yes, as far as we know, every poll that I've seen for the last 9 or 10 years has indicated that majorities of Palestinians are in favor of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. The way you get to that is not entirely clear, and I think the degree of despair among Palestinians, which goes up and down, is probably very high right now, and the number of Palestinians who believe that it's going to be possible to achieve that is probably pretty small. But last polls that I've seen still indicated a majority supported that as a solution.
Okay, so you have a number of Palestinians, and this has to do with a lot of how the events went and have, you know, gone up and down, et cetera, et cetera. And it also has to do with the type of leadership you have. If you don't feel that your leadership is going to take you in a particular direction that has any salvation, you're likely to go for anything and just basically vote for anything, whether you believe in it or not. It's similar to how a lot of people argue and fuss over the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, and then they pull the lever for one or the other. They know deep in their heart, many of them. I'm talking about just the working class mass. I'm not talking about some 1% elite that knows what the hell is going on, that there's not going to be any fundamental change in their lives and stuff. But since there's not an organ, there's not a movement to take them to the next step in a real fashion, they'll start to rationalize and kind of go for any okey-doke.
Well, here's the other problem, right? And that is, what is the real possibility? See, what people believe in part is shaped by what's going on before their eyes. Now, if indeed there was a militant opposition, well, excuse me, there is a militant opposition within Israel. There are soldiers that refuse to serve in the occupied areas and have actually gone to prison behind us here. There are, you know, socialists who ain't with it, you know, and support the Palestinians in some way. But they are minuscule. They're a small number of people. But insofar as people see, if they saw some real class struggle against the Israeli bourgeoisie going on, I bet you the number of people that want a separate state would go down overnight. Because that's the thing is, how do we defeat the capitalists? Because in the modern world, if you want to go forward, that's what you have to do. You got to deal with the capitalists. No, since the major groups in the field do not offer a program with which to do that, people fall back to that, you know, two-state solution, which is not a real solution, in my opinion.
Now, to go into some of the historical aspects, there was the Earl Peel process, more or less, which at one time was supposed to be set up for a small state for Jews. But as things developed, it developed to where the Zionists were basically saying, look, there's going to be no room for us and the Arabs. Here's what I mean. Check this out.
The British government's formal response to the 1936 uprising came in the form of the appointment of a royal commission headed by Earl Peel to investigate the situation. And the commission entertained the idea of formally partitioning Palestine into Jewish and Arab sections. The Peel Commission envisioned a small Jewish state, one that included the Galilee, the Jezreel Valley, and the coastal plain that runs from Acre to Tel Aviv. All the rest of historic Palestine, except Jerusalem, which would be ruled under the terms of a British mandate, were to be included in the Arab state. The commission also proposed a formal separation of the population, as well as Jewish and British financial support for the new Arab government. It was also suggested that the state would merge with Transjordan under the leadership of Amir Abdallah. The Arab High Commission rejected the plan, and soon David Ben-Gurion expressed his reservations as well, proposing that the Zionists should hold out for a better deal. But Joseph Weitz, director of the Jewish Land Fund, knew that after the war, the problem would reach a crisis. He wrote in his diaries, "After the Second World War, the question of the land of Israel and the questions of the Jews would be raised beyond the framework of development amongst ourselves. It must be clear that there is no room for both peoples in this country. If the Arabs leave the country, it will be broad and wide open for us. And if the Arabs stay, the country will remain narrow and miserable. And there is no way besides transferring the Arabs from here to the neighboring countries to transfer them all, except maybe from Bethlehem, Nazareth, and Old Jerusalem. We must leave not a single village, not a single tribe. There is no other way up."
But from 1937, when the first British partition plan was put forward, which would have given created a small Jewish state and a large Arab area which would have been annexed to Jordan, King Abdullah, Amir Abdullah, was intent on expanding his area of influence into Palestine. And this was something that was welcome to both the British and to the Zionists, because he intended on doing so at the expense of the Palestinians, and in place of their national movement and in place of their aspirations for independence.
So once again, you see how the Palestinians got caught in the crosshair of imperial politics and the whole national nationalistic politics of Zionism, and how this helps fester the role of capitalism and capital expansion and bargaining and giveaways and all of that. They were bargaining Palestinian land away the same way that these politicians in America bargain away the air and the quality of water and stuff like that. Recently, you know, it came out that in California, particular chemicals of jet fuel are getting into the water table because they just wash out the damn jets after, you know, so long, and that these have cancerous effects at certain parts per, you know, million and stuff. And the scientists have already said that there should be no parts per million, but because of political pressure, they're basically in compromise. They're basically saying, well, we could have 1 to 2 parts per. And then the corporations and the military is already saying, well, we want 6 parts. So already right there, you're seeing the seeds of what's going to take a place in raising the cancer level and other, if not cancer, messing up the hormonal structures of human beings. And a report's coming out that it shows that it lowers the IQ rate of little infants, you know, things like that. But these things are all negotiable to the capitalists, you know, in the same way that the issue of Palestine was. Now next, Neil, oh, hold on.
Yeah, let me just, by the way, that's very informative, some of the information that we're hearing now about the basic history here. But people should keep in mind, and that's why I talk about class struggle. See, when class struggle enters the fray, nationalism is in trouble. That's right. When we all have a possibility of being free, people don't want to recede to their respective corners, let's say. What's happening now, people should know that Joseph Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union, the dictator that murdered thousands of revolutionaries on his climb to bureaucratic power in the Soviet Union, actually recognized Israel in 1948. Years later, by the 60s, when the Palestinian struggle for self-determination had heated up, the Soviet Union was giving support to the Palestinians. Notice, as soon as the Soviet Union drops off the scene around 1992-93, the intensity with which Israel deals with the Palestinians goes off the scale. Bombing whole cities. I mean, this stuff they've been pulling, I'm talking about Jenin. Y'all. And all the other stuff, this is off the map stuff. This is don't make no sense. This is not how you deal with dissent. So, here again, you got to see the geopolitical, you know, implications of who's supporting Israel. What is Israel now? It's a little pit bull in the Middle East, controlled by the United States, who provide them with their weapons. And this way, they keep control of the entire Middle East by supporting that one country. And why? What's the reason? In a word, oil.
Now next, Neil Cohen asked about the divide between those who support the two-state solution and Hamas's position. So let's see how this is dealt with, and then we'll go from there. Check this out.
And there is a divide, though, between those who support that And Hamas, we just saw the founder and guiding light of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin, assassinated last week, which is the latest turn. I guess people are still waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. Hamas and other groups have never subscribed to a two-state solution. Something that David Magofsky didn't touch on, but which I think is worth at least mentioning, is that there appeared to be something of a change among certain leaders of Hamas in recent months. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the existence of Israel in the long term, were both talking about an accommodation over decades, or in the case of one statement, 100 years with Israel. Were Israel to be willing to withdraw from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? And in one statement, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin said, and, you know, it'll be up to later generations to decide what comes next. Now, what that really meant, only God knows, because both men, coincidentally, have been assassinated by Israel. And what we have left are people like Khaled Mash'al in Damascus and Abdelaziz Fantisi, who've never expressed any such accommodationist views at any time in the past, and in fact have been against even the limited ceasefires that Hamas has subscribed to. It was Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and others who imposed those limited ceasefires, which Mash'al and Fantisi and other even more hardline members of what is, in fact, a very radical group themselves never accepted. So I think it's a point worth mentioning, not that Hamas has ever yet changed, as far as we know, from opposition in principle to a two-state solution, but that some leaders were apparently willing to envisage some form of limited accommodation over a limited period of time.
All right, now, you know, he goes in and talks about Hamas and how they never subscribed to a two-state solution and things like that. And the part I'm going to deal with here is how for many quote-unquote progressives, they look at Hamas and some of the things that are going on as the only way that the Palestinians can struggle, you know, as far as the suicide bombings and things of that particular nature. Now, I'm not against using armed force or anything like that, but on a certain level and at a certain time, it becomes pretty obvious that Hamas is really not trying to develop a revolutionary cadre. And what I mean by this is that you have a situation where you have to develop, if you're serious about defending your area and region from attacks and things, you have to develop skilled snipers. Now, this is not all that difficult. You know, you get young people and stuff, and you can even give them high-powered pellet guns and see which ones have real good eye coordination, shooting hand-eye coordination, and you pick the take the elite out of there and start training them in sniper skills. Teach them to be patient, teach them how to live in different regions, and then so that the Israelis just can't walk up all the time, you know, just like how Sharon walked up into one of these Temple Mount areas. He wasn't even worrying about getting sniped off. Why? Because the way Hamas is organized, they're not developing their cadre for skilled marksmanship and things of that nature. They should have people, if they're able to penetrate as easily as they are into Israel all the time and do suicide bombings, with the technology that is available now, you could put all types of remote detection things, listening devices and things like that. All of Palestine should be located with surveillance cameras so you can see when they're coming around, so you can monitor them and stuff. So all of this type of stuff is necessary if you're serious. But if you aren't really serious and you have like a hierarchical structure, you don't really want to develop your cadre, or your ideology does not want to develop it consciously or not, because the best way to not be challenged by a revolutionary developing cadre is basically to just blow them up. I mean, you're basically getting the most vibrant and committed people for the most part. And what are they doing? Are they going to be the next Chase? You don't know, because you're blowing them up. Are they going to be the next Malcolms, the next Harriet Tubmans? They're all blowing up. So at that, so if you have an organization that's developed in that strata, you'll never be challenged to take on a more revolutionary position because a revolutionary position would challenge some of these tactics. It's not like I'm saying don't ever do suicide bombing. That's not really the issue. What I'm saying is that you want to develop a cadre that is able to broaden the scope of resistance and give encouragement to the masses that we can defend ourselves. Now, an example of how, in many ways, that this is not really serious is that when's the last time you've seen some Palestinians dancing around a Black Hawk American-made helicopter shot down by the Palestinians that was Israeli flown? Now, no one can tell me that they don't have the means of technology. If the Somalians can shoot and hit four and force two to crash down to the ground in one day, then surely the Palestinians can. If you have a 50-millimeter gun or a RPG, rocket-propelled grenade launcher, you can knock one of those down. These things aren't just made, you know, so they're invincible. It's the mindset. It's the mindset. And that gets to the point of what I'm saying as far as how these types of organizations are set up. It's almost set up in a martyrdom slash fatalistic mindset, so where you never develop the cadre that's necessary. You'll never be challenged by the cadre because you never get past one form of a particular resistance when you can expand well beyond that form. Now, in Cuba, Che and them in the earlier stages had what were called suicide missions and suicide cadres. But as time went on and they were able to develop themselves and their means, they went well past that. And they had prepared the core of their cadres who first went over beforehand in shooting skills and stuff like that. Che was doing that in Mexico with the group before they even left. So what I'm saying is that with the technology and other things, if an organization is serious about developing themselves and their cadre and getting them to understand various forms of armed resistance, and I'm just sticking to the armed resistance because, of course, there's many other elements, but just even the basic forms of armed resistance and sniper skills and stuff like that, if you don't develop that, then basically you're just more or less spinning your wheels. Now, hold on a second.
You're more like fish in a damn barrel is what you are. But we got to go back, Tracy. Now, how is that possible? Because really, there was a lot of militancy and intellectual leftism inside of the Arab world. This was pretty much wiped out through the years. And what occurred was the Israeli government created,
I mentioned that earlier,
Hamas to offset the secular political power of Arafat and his crew. Now, therefore, what we had was an organization that was created by the enemy. Here's where it changed. When the first Arab, how do you say, Antifada?
You know, Antifada.
Antifada came
Antifada.
In. Right, the Antifada came in. Masses of people did flock to Hamas, and that changed the character of the organization. At least it stabilized it and made it an organization that was known for fighting the Israelis on some level. People are so demoralized that this martyrdom thing actually, I mean, do you know, interesting fact, that when a person blows themselves up as a suicide bomber, their family receives $30,000 cash. I think that is so sad. It encourages it. It encourages it. No, your program generates your theory, and your theory is the plaque upon which you train your cadre. If you got a program that's full of Islamic fundamentalism, you will not develop revolutionary cadre, because Islamic fundamentalism is not a revolutionary program.
Now, there's some parallels in many ways about how the Zionists justify what's going on in the Israeli Zionists justify what's going on in Palestine, Israel, in the same way that a lot of Islamic Zionists justify what's going on in the Sudan, because the Arabs are not indigenous to the Sudan. They came there as occupiers and slavers, literally slavers. They, the government, the National Islamic Front, is consistently firebombing regions of the south and in the Nuba Mountains, which is not even the south, but is basically various strongholds of the black population, you know, Nubas, Dinkas, etc. How they justify it is they're justifying it through a whole religious fervor, in the same way that the Zionists in Israel are justifying it through a religious fervor. Now, since there's such a lack of critical and radical understanding amongst the left, what you often get is like, this kind of KPFA-ish, no violence ever type of thing in Palestine, Israel is the solution, and that the Palestinians should not be resisting with violence in any form. And then you have other people who will uncritically support any type of resistance that Hamas is engaged in, yet they don't even know or understand various other forms of armed resistance, like I was mentioning, in development of armed resistance. And many of them don't even know the difference between an AK-47 and a Glock. So they're just faking it, is what I'm saying. So you have that situation going on. And this has helped perpetuate these types of crises that are going on in the world. Now, to deal with some more of the history aspect, after the UN partition of the Palestine-Israel issue after 1947, Plan D was put into effect by the Zionists, and its nightmarish aftermath is laid clear. Check this out.
Starting in late 1947, after the UN decided to partition the country, a fighting broke out, and there began systematic expulsion of Palestinians, and particularly in areas where Jews wanted to create a state. The end result was that of the more than 1 million Palestinians, approximately somewhere between 700 and 800,000 were expelled from their homes. More than 500 towns and villages were depopulated or destroyed, and these people became refugees.
On April 19, 1947, the Israelis Irgun and LH-1 units attacked the Arab village of Deir Yassin. 250 Palestinians were killed. Most of those killed were non-combatants. There were also cases of mutilation and rape. Word of the massacre spread quickly, and while officially condemned by Jewish authorities, Irgun commander and future Israeli premier Menachem Begin stated, "We created terror among the Arabs and all the villages around. In one blow, we changed the strategic situation." The legend of Deir Yassin spread panic among thousands of Palestinians.
The experience of Palestinians and the knowledge of the Palestinian people from their experiences always that they had been systematically terrorized into leaving their homes. There were massacres, there were forced marches on which many people died, as we saw recently in Kosovo, where a few massacres were enough to terrify people into leaving.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about myths and fallacies and ignorance and a curtain of misinformation, what happened in 1947-48 is probably one of the most important periods where people really don't know what happened. One of the key things to remember is that the fighting started long before May 15th, when the State of Israel was established and several Arab armies entered the country. It started, in fact, the moment that partition was announced in November 1947. And it was essentially a war of positions with ambushes and terrorism for many, many months. But in the spring of 1948, the issue of the Jewish community in Palestine, the Zionist movement, was able to mobilize its forces and win a sort of rolling series of crushing victories.
The wholesale clearances of the Arab populations was the result of a well-planned Zionist operation called Plan D. Plan D was conceived to create fear and terror, and it succeeded.
Anybody who has the capacity to leave a war zone is likely to think of their children, their personal safety, and leave. If you have a strong state that can force you to stay, or that can organize things to defend you, you're less likely to leave. But that wasn't the case for the Palestinians, for a variety of reasons. They didn't have a state. They didn't have even a para-state. And as a result, a lot of people fled just out of fear. The fact is, the Arabs left not because their leaders told them to, not because of some diabolical plan, but essentially because they were driven out or because their homes became unsafe.
So once again, you have a situation where there was a program by the Zionists for the liquidation of the people. And those Zionist types will always use the leadership, will always use their religion and other things to justify the conquest. That's basically what Manifest Destiny was about in America, using religion to justify the westward expansion and conquest of the native aboriginal population in America. It was just Christian Zionism. In Palestine, Israel, we see Hebrew Zionism. And in the Sudan and other regions, we see Islamic Zionism. And we have denial by all of these groups in these particular sectors, you know, religious sectors. Another book has come out called Mende Nazar. It's called Slave, My True Story. This is about a sister who's a Nuba, as it says, who lost her childhood in a horrific night in 1993 when Arab raiders swept through her Nuba village on horseback. The raiders set fire to the village huts, murdered the adults, slitting their throats with knives. They rounded up 31 young children. Minda was 12 years old at the time. A slave trader brought Minda to Sudan's capital city, which is Khartoum, and sold her to a wealthy Arab family, and so began Minda's dark years of enslavement. Her Arab owners called her Yabit, or black slave, etc., etc., etc. She describes in detail what happened on the night of the slave raid as her father shouted, quote, "If the Arabs try to take you, they'll have to kill me first." This is about Islamic Arabic expansionism in the Sudan. How they're getting their various troops is by demonizing the indigenous black population and putting in all of this religious fervor in it. You'll often see many Muslims who are progressive on Palestinian issues and what's going on in Iraq as backwards as the many Zionists are on issues concerning Palestine, Israel, and as backwards as many Christian fanatic types are on the issue of the liquidation of the Aboriginal Indians in North America. Now, these entities are set up in a hierarchical structure where they generally protect themselves. In other words, there's like an unwritten agreement where they believe in the conquest of empires and regions over one another, but they believe that the ruling classes in their particular region should conquer one another. They don't believe in the masses uprising, so they'll even help each other put down their massive the masses of the people in their own population. This is in essence what you saw when the ruling class in America, from Ford to General Electric, helped the Nazis and Adolf squash down the masses of working class people in Germany. Now, they later went to war again, but that was one ruling class against another. But they helped Adolf squash the working class population in their particular class. Now, at the same time, you've seen one of the main things that's considered gold in Israel is water. That's one thing they have a lack of. One thing that the government of Khartoum in the Sudan always wants, the National Islamic Front, the government that took power in a coup in Khartoum, what they always want is weaponry. Now, who did Israel get water from? The National Islamic Front, the government in charge in Khartoum. Even though they're an Islamic Arabic country who screams as much about what the Zionists are doing to the Palestinians as any other Arabic nation, but they understand something on a ruling class level, that the Arab, that the Zionists in Israel got to keep their disposable people down, and the Zionists over in Israel understand that the Arabs have to keep their disposable people down, the black population. So the Zionists in the Sudan give them water. The Zionists in Israel give them weaponry, and the game just keeps going on. And people who get lost in this justification of whatever is going on because it happens to be the invisible man that they bend their little knees to help play in to all of this. Now, the last thing on KQED was a caller from Virginia who asked about the 7-day war, and he tries to give an analogy and a justification, more or less, of the Israeli domination of that region after the war. Check this out.
A caller on the line, and this is Doug, who's with us from Springfield, Virginia.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
My question for your company, you'll forgive me, it's my first time. I'm a little nervous, so I might stutter here.
That's all right.
Now, you have to forgive me. You may have to explain some history to me here, but if I remember correctly, when Israel first was given the land in 1948 by the United Nations, it did not include the Golan Heights or the West Bank. It was not until they were attacked, I believe, in the 1967 or the Seven-Day War, where they lost that land. And if I might pose a little analogy and get your comment on it, it seems like a new kid that comes in on the block and seven bullies who don't want him on their turf come down to fight him. Not only does he beat all seven of them, but he takes their shirts. And they all come back later crying that he stole their shirts. When in fact, I would say in that case that to the victor belong the spoils. And the last thing I'd like to say and get your comment on is another person mentioned earlier about the mission statement of the Palestinian organization and Hamas to drive the Jews into the sea. And it almost seems like the land issue, though maybe not for all, for most, is really just a straw man. The issue is racial hatred against the Jews and Judaism. You can listen to that for many of the callers who call into this very program. Though they won't come out and say it, you hear it in the rhetoric that they say. I believe once the land issue is given to the Palestinians or they succeed in that, the next issue that'll come to the forefront eventually is just more and more of Israel until eventually their mission statement is filled to drive them into the sea. If I could have that comment, please, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, Doug, thanks very much for the call. Rashid Khalidi, there's a lot there, beginning with a very great deal of history under a very short bridge.
Well, Doug, you are right. You do have a shaky grip of history. The drive them into the sea rhetoric is not any longer the rhetoric of the PLO or the PA, and hasn't been for, depending on how you count it, several decades, or at least 1988, when the PLO, at its National Council meeting, adopted a declaration of independence in which they accepted a two-state solution and accepted the independence of Israel. And before that, they were moving towards that. So the drive them into the sea rhetoric, which in fact is vintage 1960s Shukairi stuff. He was one of the first head of the Palestine Liberation Organization 40 years ago, has not in fact been the policy of the group that's dominated Palestinian politics for the last at least generation or so. As far as the rest of your history is concerned, well, to the victor belongs the spoils is a traditional approach before international law and before the modern world system that the United States and other victor countries established in World War II. You want to go back to the law of the jungle? Fine. A lot of people in the current administration seem to be, lusting for the law of the jungle. That may well be the way we're going. but most people tend to believe that, you know, the structure of international law and the structure created by the United Nations is something that benefits everybody and that we are better off with it. And on that basis, they would agree with the kind of position that was put forward in U.N. Security Council Resolution 242 after the Six-Day War of June 1967.
Very quickly, would you also expect that there would be little reformulation of the roadmap, the plan and rhetoric before the election?
I think that the roadmap is not going to be the subject of very much attention from anybody for the next few months, if ever again. But yes, I don't think that there's going to be much attention paid to it before the election. I doubt it.
Rashid Khalidi, thanks very much.
But,
now, this Khalid guy is this weak, because anyone with any kind of integrity or honesty knows that the world is being basically run through the law of the jungle, through the American imperialist ways, the various Zionist ways, whether we're talking about Israel, Sudan, or what Sam's doing in Iraq, etc., etc. But also in the way that Sharon has historically dealt with the indigenous population in Palestine. Here's what I mean.
Sporadic fighting continued between Arabs and Jews after 1950. Ariel Sharon began his career as a young Israeli commander in charge of new settlements, where his troops raided an Arab village and 60 villagers died.
I was brought up in a conservative congregation on Long Island, so I came up in a pretty standard, I think, middle-class Jewish environment. We weren't too religious. In fact, we weren't terribly religious, but we followed the tradition of being Jews. So I've been spending some time in the last couple of months going back and reading, you know, doing some history analysis. And what is most striking to me is that you go back to 1948 and you go to 1950s and 1967 war and the 1973 war, and they are the same names. Ariel Sharon is a great example. Ariel Sharon in the early 1950s, led a group called Unit 101. It was a special commando unit that was established by the IDF. And there was an attack on a village, and I think a hand grenade was thrown into a person's house and a couple of people were killed. And in response, Unit 101 went into this Palestinian village, it was called Kibya, and massacred like 60 people. And it was one of the most blatant, outrageous massacres at the time. They immediately covered it up by saying that it was a bunch of Israelis acting in revenge and retaliation of the killing. But in fact, it was a specific action led by Ariel Sharon. And so you have this person who has this really awful history as essentially a murderer of Palestinians from the late 1940s all the way up to today.
So once again, we're dealing with a situation where the game plan has always been the annihilation and removal of the Palestinians by any means and the subjugation of their basic rights of self-determination. So in essence, the Palestinians who are a majority Muslim have more in common with the indigenous population of the Sudan, the black population that is non-Muslim, than they do with the Arab slavers and invaders, homeland invaders, little boy castrators, you know, the government in charge in Khartoum, and those who support the subjugation of the indigenous black population in the various regions of the Sudan. This is how the game is played by those who use their various invisible man beliefs to subjugate the masses of people throughout the world. And the masses of us, until we develop the type of revolutionary formation that we need, will continue to pay the heaviest price. Hold on a sec.
From Palestine, first pictures of the latest bomb outrage. Jewish terrorists blow up the Goldsmiths Officers' Club in Jerusalem. 13 Britons were killed and 16 injured. Total casualties on this one day of violence was 18 dead and 25 injured. When the explosion occurred, four officers were sunbathing on the roof. This fact saved their lives. Our cameraman was on the spot as they came down to have their injuries dressed. Britain answered these attacks by putting whole cities under martial law. Says Palestine Commander-in-Chief General McMillan, the men responsible for these killings are not terrorists. They're just plain thugs and murderers. The false glamour which grew around the gunmen of the Stern and the Irgun bands is gone. We were put in charge of Palestine by the League of Nations. Now our men and women are being killed without reason. In spite of efforts to bring peace to the country, Britain's advice has been disregarded. Now, say the gangsters, this is war. The Palestine problem has been referred to the United Nations Assembly. But this will not take place until September. Why wait till then? The problem is not the exclusive concern of Great Britain. Others, like the Americans, are ever ready with advice. Now is the time for them to share the responsibility.
President Ronald Reagan once said, "One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter." The King David Hotel was the site of the British Command Center in Palestine. The terrorist group, the Irgun, chose it as a target after the British had invaded the Jewish agency and confiscated the agency's records. On July 22, 1946, the hotel was bombed, killing 91 people and injuring another 45, among them 15 Jews. These acts were part of a campaign of terror against the British.
Sir John Shaw, Chief Secretary with Sir Alan Cunningham, High Commissioner for Palestine, were present when the bomb exploded in the King David Hotel. They are taking strong action in rounding up all suspects of the outrage. Ramleh Cemetery. The 13 British soldiers killed were buried here with Mr. Kennedy, the Postmaster General. The cortege went under armed escort from Jerusalem to Ramleh by road. Bearer parties came from the 6th Airborne Division. Of the victims, Sir John Shaw said their only crime was their devoted, unselfish, and impartial service to Palestine and its peoples. They have been rewarded by cold-blooded mass murder. I shall mourn them as long as I live. A direct challenge to the United Nations and its powers of war prevention comes from Palestine. The definition of legal and illegal forces becomes daily more obscure. Haganah, the force first legally raised for the defense of Jewish settlements, appears to function hand in glove with Irgun Sfai Leumi, the outlawed terrorist army. Full-scale training is underway in a score of camps throughout the country. There is no shortage of arms nor ammunition, though under the British mandate, possession of arms calls for the death penalty. The cameraman taking these pictures was led blindfold to the training ground. A few of the men avoided being photographed. Only the girls made a half-hearted attempt at concealment of their features. Such is the attitude towards the waning power of Britain's mandate. An active battleground is in the no-man's land between the towns of Tel Aviv and Jaffa. Here, the mock training goes a stage further. Sniping affrays are of daily occurrence.
The issue here is not strictly Bush. There's a great deal of continuity in the building of the American empire. Secrecy is at the very heart of it. Even if we had an honest Congress, you can't do oversight when 40% of the Defense Department's budget is secret. All of the intelligence agencies' budgets are secret. This has been true since the Manhattan Project during World War II.
That's going to wrap it up for Slave tonight. Says the people that it's clear that until the Zionist imperialists from all sectors, imperial Zionists that come out from the Christian side in America, those that come out from the Islamic Zionist side in the Sudans of the world, Mauritania, etc., etc., and those that exist in the matrix of Israel are eliminated. we're all going to be mired in death, disease, and poverty. So from a revolutionary standpoint, we're really going to have to do our thing until the next time slave revolt. Out.
If the music make you move, 'cause you can dig the groove.